from PRI, Public Radio International.
Only a few yards off the road, a small barn had been made into a roadside stand with a dirt driveway carving up to the front of it. A spare, red-cheeked man stood in the midst of baskets and barrels of red apples and glass jugs of red cider. He was waiting on a man and a woman. I turned into the driveway and put the brakes on hard. I had seen, just in time, a duck. It was a small, trim duck, and even I, who know nothing about wild fowl, knew that this was no barnyard duck. This was a wild duck. He was all alone.
That was Malachy McCourt reading from James Thurber's The Wood Duck, which we'll hear a bit later in the program. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, and I'm Isaiah Sheffer, the artistic director of Symphony Space, a theater on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where Selected Shorts originates. When Kathy Minton and I first read the story you're now about to hear, Eight Pieces for the Left Hand by J. Robert Lennon, a collage of related vignettes about life in a small American town, the musical reference in the title suggested a performance idea that led to one of the most remarkable experiments in the history of Selected Shorts. Symphony Space has a string quartet in residence, the marvelous Ying Quartet, made up of four talented siblings, and they're always interested in lending a chamber music dimension to our theater's literary and show business presentations, from wall-to-wall Sondheim to Selected Shorts. So, Kathy and I asked the Yings if they could suggest a musical work that could be presented along with Eight Pieces for the Left Hand, and they came up with a brilliant answer to this challenge, a Ned Roram Quartet, United States, Seven Viewpoints for String Quartet, based on images of small-town America. This quartet takes the form of seven short movements, which we thought could be alternated with the eight pieces of story. Well, it was not until the rehearsal on the afternoon of the performance date that we realized how fortuitous this literary musical pairing was going to turn out to be. I had thought, well, some good music alternating with the story sections might be an interesting novelty, but only upon hearing the rehearsal did we realize, to our general amazement, what a great fit this was, that this quartet might well have been expressly written as a score for this text. The changing moods, rhythms, and textures seemed to mesh perfectly with the character of each section of the story. Both J. Robert Lennon, the author, and Ned Roram, the composer, were present, and they were equally amazed and gratified at how well their very separate efforts had blended into an outstanding experience for the short's audience. The reader is our regular leading man, Stephen Lang. The musicians are the Ying Quartet. We hear Ned Roram's string quartet intercut with J. Robert Lennon's Eight Pieces for the Left Hand.
Autumn, once the most popular season in this town of tall trees, is now regarded with dread, thanks to the bitter athletic rivalry between our two local high schools. The school in the neighborhood, commonly called the Flats, is attended by the children of the working class, who are employed by the town's restaurants, motels, gas stations, and factories, and who live in those low-lying areas most frequently plagued by pollution, flood, and crime. The school in the Heights, on the other hand, is populated by the children of academics, who live on wooded hillside lots that offer panoramic views of our valley. Students at the Flats consider students at the Heights to be prissy, pampered, trust fund halfwits, while Heights students regard Flat students as mustachioed, inbred gas huffers. Historically, these class tensions were brought to bear in the annual football game played at our university's enormous stadium the last weekend in October. 5 years ago, however, some Heights players spray-painted ethnic slurs on the dusty American sedans of several Flats team members, and the Flats players retaliated by flinging bricks through the windows of the shiny leased sports coupes of their rivals. 4 years ago, A massive melee at a fast food restaurant landed players from both teams in the hospital. 3 years ago, the much-painted Seniors Rock in front of Flats High was rolled into a nearby creek, and the brand-new Sciences wing of Heights High was set on fire. 2 years ago, each coach was kidnapped by still unidentified members of the opposing team and traded on Friendship Bridge at midnight of game day. And last year, the Flats' beloved mascot, the marauding goat, was disemboweled before the war memorial in Peters Park. While not a mile away, the starting quarterback for the Heights was partially paralyzed in a hit-and-run incident outside a drive-up bank. The subsequent game was canceled. This year's game has also been canceled, but for a different reason entirely. A steep drop in the population of our town has made the existence of both high schools fiscally untenable. And beginning with the fall semester, the two will be combined into a single entity to be called Area High. It remains unclear how the rivalry will play itself out, but many seem convinced that the solution lies in targeting a common enemy, such as the students of nearby Valley High, thought by all to be buck-toothed hicks, or those of faraway City Regional, who, everyone knows, are greasy-haired gangbangers. Meanwhile, the peace here in our town remains uneasy, and we await with trepidation the turning of the leaves. A local poet of considerable national fame completed a new collection of poems that had, due to a painful and scandalous series of personal problems, been delayed in editing and publication for some years. When the revisions were finally finished, the poet typed up a clean copy of the manuscript and got into his car to bring it to the copy shop for reproduction. On the way, however, the poet was pulled over for running a red light and was subsequently found to be drunk. Due to a new and unforgiving drunk driving law in our state, his car was taken from his possession and his license revoked. Upon regaining sobriety, the poet realized that his poetry manuscript was still in the car and asked the police to return it to him. The police, however, maintained that the contents of the car no longer belonged to him and refused. Their refusal resulted in a protracted legal battle, during which our beloved poet died, leaving uncertain the fate of the manuscript. But the poet's publisher, eager to issue a posthumous volume, struck a bargain with the police department. If someone at the station would read the finished poems over the phone, an editor could transcribe them and issue them in book form without the manuscripts changing hands. After all, the publisher argued, even if the manuscript legally belonged to the city, its contents did not, as they were devised outside the poet's car. The police agreed to this scheme. The phone recitation took place, and the book was issued to great acclaim, assuring the poet a place in the literary canon that he had not enjoyed in life. Eventually, however, the poet's estate won its legal battle against the city, and the original manuscript was recovered. All were shocked to learn that it bore little resemblance to the published book. It was not long before a city policeman confessed to having improvised much of the manuscript during its telephone transcription. His only explanation was that he saw room for improvement and could not resist making a few changes here and there. Almost immediately, the policeman was asked to leave the force, and the acclaimed book was completely discredited. The true manuscript was published in its entirety to tepid reviews. The policeman has continued to write poetry. Most agree that it is excellent, but few will publish the work of someone known to be so dishonest. A farmer who lives on our road had lost 3 mailboxes in as many weeks to the drunken antics of some local youths who had taken to driving past late at night and smashing the mailboxes with a baseball bat. Because the police had been uncooperative in apprehending the youths, the farmer devised a solution to the problem. He bought two mailboxes, a gigantic industrial-strength one and a small aluminum one, and arranged the boxes one inside the other with a layer of cement between the two. He mounted this monstrous megabox on a length of 8-inch steel pipe, which was set into a 4-foot post hole and stabilized there with 30 additional gallons of cement. The following weekend, the youths sped past in their convertible, and T, the captain of the high school baseball team and a local slugger of some renown, swung at the box from a standing position in the back seat. With the bat moving at more than 75 miles per hour relative to the car, and the car itself traveling nearly as fast, the combined velocity of the impact was approximately 150 miles per hour. It was at this speed that the bat ricocheted and struck the head of Jay, a 17-year-old girl sitting in the car, killing her instantly. A series of criminal charges and civil suits followed. T was tried as an adult and convicted of involuntary manslaughter. The driver of the car was sentenced to community service on charges of vandalism and reckless endangerment. The farmer was also convicted of reckless endangerment and fined. In response, he sued the police department for failing to address the problem beforehand. The parents of the dead girl lobbied to have all the car's living occupants, 5 in all, expelled from school. They also sued T, the driver, and the farmer for several $1 million. They even tried and failed to sue the hardware store where the farmer had bought his cement mailbox supplies, arguing that the store's employees ought to have figured out what the farmer was doing and stopped him. In a peripheral case, T's parents sued the hospital where he was treated for a broken arm. Apparently, the doctors there had set the break improperly, resulting in a painful resetting that was likely to ruin T's chances to play baseball in the major leagues. Their lawyers demanded a percentage of T's projected future salary. In the end, all charges were reversed on appeal. It seemed that everyone involved was to blame, which the courts determined was no different from no one being to blame. All that remains, apart from the many legal debts incurred by the litigants and the accused, is the cement mailbox, which has proven too costly and cumbersome to remove. One night, while our cat was curled up on my lap, placidly purring, I noticed that his collar was somewhat crooked. And in the process of writing it, I happened to catch a glimpse of the identification tag that hung from it. The tag, a worn stamped metal disc, told me that the cat's name was Fluffy. Our cat, however, was named Horace. Reading further, I discovered that the tag bore an address on our old street in a faraway town we had lived in temporarily, and not our permanent address. I gave the matter some thought and concluded there were two possible explanations. One was that while we were living in the faraway town, our cat's collar was switched with another cat's, perhaps as some kind of prank. The other was that we had accidentally gotten hold of someone else's cat and abandoned our own. Initially, I dismissed the second possibility, as it had been 5 years since we lived in that town, and this cat had very much come to seem like ours and the town we lived in permanently his rightful home. But as I reflected, I realized how very unlikely a prank the switching of collars was, and simultaneously I began to recall changes in our cat's personality around the time of our move, which quite naturally we assumed to be consequences of the move itself, but which now suddenly seemed like the consequences of our having taken possession of an entirely different cat. On impulse, I got up and called the phone number printed on the tag. A woman answered. I asked her if she had lost a cat named Fluffy, and after a long pause, she replied that, yes, she had, many years ago. And did I have some information about him? I told her that I had found his collar unconnected to any cat. Did she want me to send it to her? After a dramatic pause, the woman told me to go ahead and do so, and I did the next day. I also ordered through a pet supply catalog a new tag with the name Horace printed on it. Though I no longer consider this to have been a cowardly act, I went through several weeks of self-doubt at the time. As for now, I can only hope that the original Horace was taken in by a kind family. At a bend in a winding country road outside our town, there once lived a family whose only child, a girl, was born deaf. When the girl grew old enough to play outside on her own, the family had the county erect a yellow sign near the house, which read, "Deaf Child Area." The idea was that motorists would drive more slowly, knowing that a nearby child could not hear their approach. By the time I was a boy, the deaf child had become a teenager, and after a while left town for college. She returned occasionally to visit, but for the most part was no longer around. Eventually, she married and settled in a faraway city. Her parents, aware of the sign's superfluity, wrote a letter asking the county to come and take it down. But though the county promised to see to the matter, no workman ever arrived. At about the time I myself married, the deaf child's parents retired and decided to move away to someplace warmer. They sold their house, and it was promptly bought by a local professor. The professor, however, was soon offered a position at another university, which he was obliged to occupy immediately. With no time to sell the house he had just bought, the professor hired a property management company to offer the house for rent. At this point, it caught my attention. My wife was pregnant with our first child, and we had begun to worry that our small apartment would be unsuitable for raising a family. After a look at the house in the country, we decided to rent it and soon moved in. For several months, we ignored the sign, which had grown old and battered, and at any rate, had nothing to do with us. But as winter approached and my wife's due date drew near, I noticed that her eyes lingered on the sign whenever we pulled into the driveway, and more than once I caught her staring out at it from our future child's bedroom, which we had furnished and filled with colorful toys. One night, as we lay awake in bed, my wife turned to me and asked if I might remove the sign somehow. She realized she was being irrational, but nonetheless feared the sign might bring some harm to our baby, and she didn't think she could sleep until the sign was gone. This seemed perfectly reasonable. I got out of bed and dressed, then brought a box of tools out to the roadside where I examined the sign. I saw that it had been bolted onto a metal post and that I could simply remove the sign and leave the post where it stood in the ground. I did this quickly and prepared to go inside. But something compelled me to go out behind the house and find a shovel, which I used to dig the post out of the ground. The ground was cold and the work slow going. When I finished, I took the sign and the post and put them in the back of the car and drove down to the lake, where I threw them out as far as I could into the water. They splashed onto the surface and sunk out of sight. When I returned home, my wife didn't ask me where I'd driven. After that, we slept comfortably and did so every night until our child was born without illness or defect. There were six students in our school play: Jason, Heather, Kevin, Carol, Matt, and me. But in the script, which our teachers had obtained from a catalog, our characters were given other names: Scott, Jenny, Robert, Melissa, Bill, and Larry. Since the oldest of us was seven, we had never before been in a play. and the difficulty of memorizing our lines was compounded by the necessity of learning new names for both ourselves and the others. 4 weeks we struggled through rehearsals, slowly gaining ground. Then, at the last minute, our teachers, fearing a debacle, told us to forget the stage names and simply use our own. But our teachers had acted at the very height of our put-upon duality. And their command effected a desperate confusion, which manifested itself on stage that night as complete theatrical anarchy. We addressed one another by whatever names happened to pop into our heads and forgot almost every scripted line, leaving our audience with only the vaguest notion of the drama's direction. The performance ended in chaos and tears, with our baffled parents applauding politely and our teachers holding their shocked faces in their hands. Sadly, the confusion didn't end there. For weeks, we were distracted during classes, failing to respond to our teachers' direct inquiries, and were moody and unresponsive at home. When we met in the halls or on the playground, we greeted each other with incorrect names, or none at all. Most of us recovered, but Jason has married 7 times. And Heather, from whom no one has heard in 20 years, is rumored to have gone mad. One lonely fall afternoon, I called our local mental hospital in search of her, but was told that no patient by that name was in residence. A local professor was honored, and a national newspaper ran a photograph of him writing on a chalkboard before a classroom full of students. Not long afterward, the professor was asked to speak at the annual meeting of a club for left-handed persons. In his letter, the club's president explained that he had seen the photo and noticed the professor's left-handedness. He believed the professor was a credit to lefties and would make an inspiring and enlightening guest. Included with the letter was a booklet listing the accomplishments of left-handed people, photocopied articles asserting the creative and intellectual superiority of lefties,
and a catalog of whimsical products for the left-handed, including special coffee mugs, pens, and eating utensils with pro-left-hand messages printed on them. The professor agreed to speak to the club and was given a large honorarium, free transportation, and a lavish hotel suite, complete with mini gym and sauna. When at last he stood before the assembled lefties, he thanked them for their invitation, then proceeded to berate them for their smugness and stupidity. He pointed out that he was, in fact, right-handed and only appeared left-handed in the photo because the newspaper had reversed the negative. If they'd looked a little more closely, he said, they would have noticed that the writing on the chalkboard was backward. He told them that they should honor others for their achievements and not their genetic circumstances, and then, only minutes into his speech, stepped down from the dais and caught a cab to the airport. When, years later, the professor lost his right arm in a highway crash, he was unsurprised to receive a flood of congratulatory letters, and the first in an endless stream of free lefty gift items that have appeared almost daily on his doorstep ever since. Far from being angry, he views this unfortunate turn of events as a kind of poetic justice, and even tried to apologize to the Lefties Club in a kind letter to its president. However, his speech had cut too deeply, and the lefties continued to bombard him with junk. Meanwhile, the professor has learned to play a variety of left-handed pieces on the piano and is said to be as dexterous with his left hand alone as he once was with both. He has also joined a national organization of people who have lost the use of one or more limbs and is scheduled to speak at its next annual meeting. A local novelist spent 10 years writing a book about our region and its inhabitants, which, when completed, added up to more than 1,000 pages. Exhausted by her effort, she at last sent it off to a publisher, only to be told that it would have to be cut by nearly half. Though daunted by the work ahead of her, the novelist was encouraged by the publisher's interest and spent more than a year excising material. But by the time she reached the requested length, the novelist found it difficult to stop. In the early days of her editing, she would struggle for hours to remove words from a sentence, only to discover that its paragraph was better off without it. Soon she discovered that removing sentences from a paragraph was rarely as effective as cutting entire paragraphs. Nor was selectively erasing paragraphs from a chapter as satisfying as eliminating chapters entirely. After another year, she had whittled the book down into a short story, which she sent to magazines. Multiple rejections, however, drove her back to the chopping block, where she reduced her story to a vignette, the vignette to an anecdote, the anecdote to an aphorism, and the aphorism at last to this haiku. Tiny upstate town undergoes many changes. nonetheless endures. Unfortunately, no magazine would publish the haiku. The novelist has printed it on note cards, which she can be found giving away to passers-by in our town park, where she is also known sometimes to sleep, except when the police, whose thuggish tactics she so neatly parodied in her original manuscript, bring her in on charges of vagrancy. I have a copy of the haiku pinned above my desk. Its note card, grimy and furred along the edges from multiple profferings. And I read it frequently, sometimes with pity, but always with awe.
That was J. Robert Lennon's Eight Pieces for the Left Hand, read by the actor Stephen Lang and accompanied by the Ying Quartet performing Ned Roram's United States, Seven Viewpoints for String Quartet. After a short break, we'll be back with Malachy McCourt reading a wonderful James Thurber story. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Now, the James Thurber stories that Americans know best are the ones he tells about his Ohio boyhood. We all laughed in high school at such stories as The Night the Bed Fell or The Night the Ghost Got In. But, you know, the grown-up, sophisticated James Thurber, who was a cartoonist and writer for the urbane New Yorker magazine, could also write more sophisticated and subtle humor pieces. And that's what you're about to hear now, The Wood Duck, read by the actor, writer, and political activist Malachy McCourt.
Mr. Krepp, our vegetable man, had told us we might find some cider out the New Milford Road away. We would come to a sign saying Morris Plains Farm, and that would be the place. So we got into the car, drove down the concrete New Milford Road, which is black in the centre with the dropped oil of a million cars. It's a main trunk highway. You can go 50 miles an hour on it, except where warning signs limit you to 40 or near towns 35. But nobody ever pays any attention to these signs. Even then, in November, dozens of cars flash past us with a high, ominous whine, their tires roaring rubberly on the concrete. We found Morris Plains Farm without any trouble. There was a big white house to the left of the highway. Only a few yards off the road, a small barn had been made into a roadside stand with a dirt driveway carving up to the front of it. A spare, red-cheeked man stood in the midst of baskets and barrels of red apples and glass jugs of red cider. He was waiting on a man and a woman. I turned into the driveway and put the brakes on hard. I had seen, just in time, a duck. It was a small, trim duck, and even I, who know nothing about wildfowl, knew that this was no barnyard duck. This was a wild duck. He was all alone. There was no other bird of any kind around, not even a chicken. He was immensely solitary. With none of the awkward waddling of a domestic duck, he kept walking busily around in the driveway, now and then billing up water from a dirty puddle in the middle of the drive. His obvious contentment, his apparent perfect adjustment to his surroundings, struck me as something of a marvel. I got out of the car and spoke about it to a man who had driven up behind me in a rattly sedan. He wore a leather jacket and high, hard boots, and I figured he would know what kind of duck this was. He did.
"That's a wood duck," he said. "It dropped in here about 2 weeks ago, Len says, and has been here ever since."
The proprietor of the stand, in whose direction my informant had nodded as he spoke, helped his customers load a basket of apples into their car and walked over to us. The duck stepped with a little flutter of its wings into the dirty puddle, took a small, unconcerned swim, got out again, ruffling its feathers. "It's a rather odd place for a wood duck, isn't it?" asked my wife. Len grinned and nodded. We all watched the duck.
"He's a banded duck," said Len. "There's a band on his leg. The State Game Commission sends out a lot of them. This one lighted here 2 weeks ago. It was on a Saturday, and he's been around ever since."
It's funny he wouldn't be frightened away with all the cars going by and all the people driving in, I said. Len chuckled.
"He seems to like it here," he said.
The duck wandered over to some sparse grass at the edge of the road aimlessly, but with an air of settled satisfaction.
"He's as tame as anything," said Len. "I guess they get tame when them fellows band them."
The man in the leather jacket said, "Course they haven't let you shoot wood duck in a long time, and that might make them tame too." "Still," said my wife, we forgot about the cider for the moment, "it's strange he would stay here, right on the road almost."
"Sometimes," said Len reflectively, "he goes round the back of the barn, but mostly he's here in the drive."
"But don't they," she asked, "let them loose in the woods after they're banded? I mean, aren't they supposed to stock up the forests?"
"I guess they're supposed to," said Len, chuckling again, "but it appears this one didn't want to."
An old Ford truck lurched into the driveway, and two men in the seat hailed the proprietor. They were hunters, big, warmly dressed, heavily shod men. In the back of the truck was a large bird dog. He was an old pointer, and he wore an expression of remote disdain for the world of roadside commerce. He took no notice of the duck. The two hunters said something to Len about cider, and I was about to chime in with my order when the accident happened. A car went by the stand at 50 miles an hour, leaving something scurrying in its wake. It was the duck turning over and over on the concrete. He turned over and over swiftly but lifelessly, like a thrown feather duster, and then he lay still. "My God," I cried, "they've killed your duck, Len." The accident gave me a quick feeling of anguished intimacy with the bereaved man. "Oh, no," he wailed. "No, that's awful." None of us for a moment moved. Then the two hunters walked toward the road slowly, self-consciously, a little embarrassed in the face of this quick, incongruous ending of a wild fowl's life in the middle of a concrete highway. The pointer stood up, looked after the hunters, raised his ears briefly, and then lay down again. It was the man in the leather jacket, finally, who walked out to the duck and tried to pick it up. As he did so, the duck stood up. He looked about him like a person who has been abruptly wakened and doesn't know where he is. He didn't ruffle his feathers. "Oh, he isn't quite dead," said my wife. I knew how she felt. We were going to have to see the duck die. Somebody would have to kill him, finish him off. Len stood beside us. My wife took hold of his arm. The man in the leather jacket knelt down, stretched out a hand, and the duck moved slightly away. Just then, from out behind the barn limped a setter dog, a lean, white setter dog with black spots. His right back leg was useless, and he kept it off the ground. He stopped when he saw the duck in the road and gave it a point, putting his head out, lifting his front leg, maintaining a wavering, marvelous balance on two legs. He was like a drunken man drawing a bead with a gun. This new menace, this anticlimax, was too much. I think I yelled. What happened next, as fast as the automobile happened? The setter made his run, a limping, wobbly run, and he was in between the men and the bird before they saw him. The duck flew, got somehow off the ground a foot or two, and tumbled into the grass of the field across the road, the dog after him. It seemed crazy, but the duck could fly, a little anyway. "Hear, hear," said Len weakly. The hunter shouted, I shouted, my wife screamed, "He'll kill him, he's kill him." The duck flew a few yards again, the dog at his tail. The dog's third plunge brought his nose almost to the duck's tail, and then one of the hunters tackled the animal, pulled him down, and knelt in the grass holding them. We all breathed easier. My wife let go Len's arm. Len started across the road after the duck, who was fluttering slowly, waveringly, but with a definite purpose toward a wood that fringed the far side of the field. The bird was dazed, but a sure atavistic urge was guiding him. He was going home. One of the hunters joined Len in his pursuit. The other came back across the road, dragging the indignant setter. The man in the leather jacket walked beside them. We all watched Len and his companion reach the edge of the wood and stand there looking. They had followed the duck through the grass slowly so as not to alarm him. He had been alarmed enough. "He'll never come back," said my wife. Len and the hunter finally turned and came back through the grass. The duck had got away from them. We walked out to meet them at the edge of the concrete. Cars began to whiz by in both directions. I realized with wonder that all the time the duck and the hunters and the setter were milling around in the road, not one had passed. It was as if traffic had been held up so that our little drama could go on.
"He couldn't have been much hurt," said Len. "Likely just grazed and pulled along in the wind of the car. Them fellows don't look out for anything. It's a sin."
My wife had a question for him. "Does your dog always chase the duck?" she asked.
"Oh, that ain't my dog," said Len. "He just comes around."
The hunter, who had been holding the setter, now let him go, and he slunk away. The pointer, I noticed, lay with his eyes closed. "But doesn't the duck mind the dog?" persisted my wife.
"Oh, he minds him," said Len. "But the dog's never really hurt him, none yet. There's always somebody around."
We drove away with a great deal to talk about. I almost forgot the cider. I explained the irony. I think I explained the profound symbolism of a wild duck's becoming attached to a roadside stand. My wife strove simply to understand the duck's viewpoint. She didn't get anywhere. I knew even then in the back of my mind what would happen. We decided after a cocktail to drive back to the place and find out if the duck had returned. My wife hoped it wouldn't be there on account of the life it led in the driveway. I hoped it wouldn't be because I felt that would be somehow too pat an ending. Night was falling when we started off again for Morris Plains Farm. It was a 5-mile drive, and I had to put my bright lights on before we got there. The barn door was closed for the night. We didn't see the duck anywhere, and the only thing to do was to go up to the house and inquire. I knocked on the door, and a young man opened it. Is the proprietor here? I asked. He said no, he'd gone to Waterbury. We wanted to know, my wife said, whether the duck came back. What? He asked, a little bit startled, I thought. And then, oh, the duck! I saw him around the driveway when my father drove off. He stared at us, waiting. I thanked him and started back to the car. My wife lingered, explaining for a moment. He thinks we're crazy, she said. When she got back into the car. We drove on a little distance. Well, I said, he's back. I'm glad he is, in a way, said my wife. I hated to think of him all alone out there in the woods.
That was James Thurber's The Wood Duck, read for us by Malachy McCourt. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.